number 061403 at all. Main Public Utilities Commission, petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. In this case, petitioner, Main Public Utilities Commission. Right, petitioner's first rebuttal at all. Mr. Dennis has responded, he's the best for the interview.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lisa Fink. I represent the Maine Public Utilities Commission. I will be sharing time with John Wright for the Connecticut Attorney General's Office. Mr. Wright will address the mobile CR arguments and the jurisdiction argument. I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Can I just ask once, do you agree with the jurisdictional argument?
We did not join the brief.
Does that mean you disagree with them?
We simply chose not to make that argument.
Do you agree or disagree?
I don't have my client's position on that. My client instructed me not to sign on to that argument, so we didn't. I'm not prepared to argue at that point.
All right.
I will address three aspects of the FERC's approval of the contested settlement. First, FERC's conclusion that the contested settlement was just and reasonable as a package. Second, its conclusion that the transition payments are just and reasonable compensation for existing generation. And third, FERC's justification for non-locational transition payments, including its dismissal of evidence of transmission constraints that limit the ability to transmit power from Maine to the rest of Poole. FERC has an obligation.
That last bit of evidence is produced in support of Maine. What? Maine gets a lower rate because they have excess power that can't be sent anywhere else?
The last point.
Was that the purpose of that evidence?
The purpose of the evidence is that a different, and we suggest lower rate should have been found.
Did I say that wrong?
No.
Did I say it wrong, ma'am? Did I say it incorrectly?
No, you said it very well, Your Honor. And I agree with you. Yes, it's a lower rate.
It's because you couldn't transmit your power, so the consumers in Maine should get a lower rate because you have excess power.
The reason, Your Honor, that we have...
I'm trying to understand what your position is.
If I could explain what our position is, the reason that Maine has excess power...
I'm not blaming you for having excess power. Okay. I'm just trying to figure out what it is you wanted that evidence in.
Yes, we have surplus capacity,
yes.
And... FERC's whole case was that the value of capacity should be influence the cost that consumers are paying, and here where there is a surplus, the value is very small, and we never had a chance to provide evidence of why there should be a locational difference.
I mean, FERC's response in part was, we're not dealing with that issue in this proceeding.
FERC's response, surprisingly, in every hearing was the issue, this case is not about export constraints, but the whole case started about the need for a locational capacity mechanism because of constraints. And so to say that the case was not about constraints was arbitrary and capricious, where the whole focus of the case was about location.
Well, that's ultimately resolved by, what is it, 2010, 2011, is that correct?
The locational capacity mechanism goes in. Our position is 4 years of rates. A four-year delay in the locational mechanism was arbitrary and capricious, where FERC had said until the contested settlement came in that it was crucial to have a locational mechanism without delay. And the only difference here is that the parties agreed to a four-year delay, and that's not a sufficient reason to change its course. FERC also said that the transition payments are just and reasonable as a package, but they failed to do any balancing to show that the...
I'm not sure you said that. Maybe I misunderstood. I don't think they said the transition...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I misspoke. The contested settlement is just and reasonable as a package, but the transition rates are no small part of the contested settlement. They're 4 years of rates costing consumers over $5 billion with a rate increase to Maine consumers of between 6 and 10%. So FERC was obligated to find that the package was just and reasonable, and it failed to do that here because it never found that the transition payments, or it failed to support its finding that the transition payments were just and reasonable.
They did find that, though, right?
They did, yes, Your Honor. They did find separately that the transition payments are just and reasonable compensation for existing generation. The problem is, there are no costs or revenues of existing generation in the record. FERC tried to juxtapose the transition, the locational installed capacity mechanism onto the transition payments to meet part of the trailblazer test of showing that petitioners or contesting parties are no worse off. But its effort there was flawed on many levels. First, all it did was mechanically lift some of the possible, it picked a few of the possible results of the litigation and compared the results to the transition payments. There's no analysis.
Let me ask you just here. As I understand, FERC's basic position is there's a serious problem. The current system is unfair and unjust and unreasonable. And we know that a lot of the existing generators are not making sufficient revenues. And we're concerned about stability and supply. And so the ISO comes up with a demand curve, and there's some other demand curves. And FERC says, basically, well, we're going to exclude the two outliers that would either result in higher or lower. And we're going to look in the middle. And we know this situation we have, where we have a current system that's unfair and unjust. And given our sort of expertise, we've looked at the cost of new entry, and we've looked at what is likely to happen if this litigation goes on. And it's our, you know, expert judgment that given this entire situation, these transition payments are sufficiently just and reasonable. Isn't that their argument?
I think that is their argument, Your Honor.
What you want them to do is to make the type of determination they would normally make in a rate making, where they have actual cost evidence and they compare it so that they either have a cost or a market analysis.
Yes, Your Honor, they are obligated under the mobile oil case to make an independent finding that the contested settlement is just and reasonable. And here, they did pull some of the results. They never explained why they chose those two, except that one was high and one was low. There's no analysis of any of the specific components. They did touch on cost of new entry, but they there's no analysis. There were several parameters that related to the administrative price setting. No analysis. But more importantly, there's no nexus between the between LICAP, which was abandoned both by FERC and the ISO, and FERC's basis for finding the transition payments just and reasonable, which is the compensation for existing generation. There's no market here, and FERC does not contend there's a market and does not contest that there's no prospect of new entry here. So its use of the transition payment of the LICAP was arbitrary and capricious. Your Honor, I've reserved 3 minutes. Your Honors, I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I.
Well, you do good. On the new entry question on the cone thing, why is it that it's, it may not be the only, it obviously isn't the only way of determining just and reasonable rates, but why isn't the cost of new entry a way of determining whether rates for existing generators is just and reasonable?
Cost of new entry is not applicable to the costs of existing generator because it's based on the costs of a peaker, a new peaker, and it's actually a starting point for this market mechanism. And
I don't understand, Council. Try to go slowly and explain what you're. I don't understand what the new peaker has to do with the price of tea. Judge Garland's question is why is not the cost of a new generator relevant to determining what is just and reasonable for existing generators?
Okay, let me try to explain in more fully.
Try not to use acronyms and jargon.
That's a very bad habit of mine. I've been practicing it for too long, I think. The reason, Your Honor, is that new existing generators, especially non-fuel units, can gain significant revenues in the energy market. And this evidence is in the record that because the clearing price in the energy market is set by the gas units, and gas prices have been, as we all know, very high, nuclear and hydro units can gain extraordinary revenues in the energy market, and these reduce the net costs of generators. So as Dr. Austin said, generators could have a significantly lower, most generators could have a significantly lower transition payment and still recover their costs. And even ISO's expert.
But that wouldn't be true of new generators. But couldn't new generators do the same thing?
Well, there's no expectation of new generators in the transition period, and FERC does not contest that there will be no generation during the transition period.
Is that your response to Judge Garland's question, that it's improper for FERC to consider the cost of new generators because there is no plan for new generators during the transition period?
That's part of the answer, Your
Honor.
Because
your first answer would apply just as equally to new generators as old generators.
You're correct,
So that was a non sequitur.
I think you drew the connection that I failed to draw, which is the costs are different for existing generators, and there are no new generators.
If costs are different for existing generators than there would be for new generators, because they're less efficient.
Because as ISO.
That doesn't help you. That would mean higher costs.
No, because ISO's own expert, Dr. Crampton, said that existing generators, the cost of new entry was significantly higher than existing generators because of significant sunk costs. Many of these units have had their costs depreciated years ago, and
but
they need very little in terms of variable cost.
But I guess I have in my back of my mind that there are cases that say it's not required to look only at historical costs in order to determine just and reasonableness.
Right.
And that another way of doing that is looking at what the current cost is of a new plant, even if the new plant's not going to go online for quite some time.
The problem,
am I wrong about that? There's no law that says that the only way to determine just and reasonableness is historical costs, right? Hope Natural Gas makes clear that that's not the only way.
If this were a cost of service case, mm-hmm. there could be issues about the test period and whether it's historical costs or going forward costs. Here, there's no nexus between the FERC's conclusion that this is a compensatory rate for existing generators and its reliance on the cost of new entry when there won't be any new entry during the transition period. It's reasonable to use a market mechanism like the cost of new entry for a market. But here, there's no market during the transition period. It's simply a...
Is it your view that FERC was obliged to use cost of service methodology for the transition payments?
Yes, it was it needed some sort of cost indicia to determine reasonableness. And where there's no market, it needs to be either a market cost or a cost-based rate. So a market rate or a cost-based rate. Here it's neither. FERC has there's no basis, no standard for FERC's determination that the rates are just and reasonable. It simply looks to the FCM as to make up for its lack of finding that 4 years of, or lack of evidence that these 4 years of rates are just and reasonable. So in conclusion, Your Honor, we would ask that this matter be remanded to the FERC for a hearing on the costs and revenues of existing generation and a determination on what the locational rate for Maine should be. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for petitioner, Connecticut.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. My name is John Wright. I'll be representing both the Connecticut Attorney General and the Massachusetts Attorney General, whose representatives are also here today. As counsel identified, I'll be speaking to two issues. First is the question of whether Section 4.C of the settlement agreement impermissibly restricts the rights of non-settling parties, in this particular case, the rights to just and reasonable rates under Section 206. The second issue will be the jurisdiction of the Commission to implement a forward capacity market that we contend is, in fact, a resource adequacy determination and interferes with the state's ability to manage its resource adequacy.
The second point that you make does not limit itself to the transition payments. Is that correct? The second point does not limit itself to the transition payments.
No, that goes to the forward capacity mechanism itself.
So that means there could be no settlement at all.
Right.
There could be the whole system has to crash.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So the argument in the brief that where you're both on, which says petitioners do not object to the auction system, they only object to the transition, that doesn't apply to you.
That applies to me.
That doesn't apply to you.
So that does not apply to us.
All right. Now, we have a case coming up, do we not? Another case that squarely presents this issue before the court?
It's a very similar case. It presents the question of whether the installed capacity requirement, also as determined by FERC, is an impermissible intrusion into states' rights.
It's the same analytical question, and that's the only issue in that case.
That is the only issue in that case, but what I also want to say is that the FERC in this particular instance has repeatedly distinguished what the forward capacity mechanism is something that only affects rates. It's only a mechanism to affect rates, and that's been repeated throughout in this
brief. So that isn't involved in the next case? Wait a minute, I misunderstood then.
The installed capacity requirement is an entirely separate issue. The arguments are very similar, but I am going to tell you today and hope to convince you today is that the mechanism that the FERC has established in this proceeding also directly impinges on the state's ability. It is not simply a determination of what the rates are, but it affects the manner, the when, the where, and the how that the states are going to be able to site new generation.
So, in other words, Brian, what you're saying is we have no alternative but to decide your issue in this case.
Yes, yes. We believe that the forward capacity market, independent of any resource adequacy requirement, is going to be an inappropriate intrusion into states' rights, and I'd be happy to...
Let me ask you, just so I'm clear on that argument. FERC responds, you know, it's undisputed, as it were, it says, you know, that we have jurisdiction over the rates. So in saying that, we have some impact on what states may or may not do. And we disclaim in writing that we are in any way affecting the state's authority to determine the level of capacity and things like that. And you're saying that's once they do the FCM, that's wrong?
Yes, yes, that's precisely my point.
And explain it to me just a little more. You say the when and how. I mean, I thought FERC's concept was that if Connecticut and Massachusetts want to build four new generators, that's up to them. We don't have anything to say about that. And why is the agency incorrect about that?
Because as the way the resource, the forward capacity market works, a state like Connecticut, left alone, has important environmental concerns. When we're citing new generation, we have to take into consideration our regional greenhouse gas initiative obligations, a low carbon unit. For example, if the state were to determine that it would be most appropriate and most optimal for us to develop a large unit, perhaps a nuclear unit, perhaps a clean coal with carbon sequestration, perhaps wind, the type of siting process for that is going to be far beyond the three-year horizon, for example, of the forward capacity market. It could take us 8 to 10 years. Under the forward capacity market, or if we're operating on our own, the state might easily say, we'll take a reserve deficiency for the next 5 years, because that's how long it's going to take us to be able to bring this new plant online. We could delay that. Under the forward capacity market, we can't delay that, because each and every year, we're going to have to go out, purchase capacity to make sure that 3 years down the road, we're going to have something. And that involves the when. It involves our being able to select a certain type of technology that we think is appropriate, but there's other fallout.
Isn't it a fact, though, that just the simple ability to set wholesale rates inevitably has an impact on the demand for and propriety of putting out new generators on board?
What I'm saying is...
And there's no question at all that FERC has authority to set wholesale rates.
Absolutely. There is no question
over that. So if you can set the rates... You're going to impact supply, right? Supply and demand, no question.
No, I think there's more nuance to it than that. We don't object to the FERC setting rates. What I object to is their stovepiping.
Of course you don't, because you know that. But my point is, just the setting of rates is going to have exactly the same consequences with respect to the new generators or no new generators that the forward capacity market would.
No, I don't agree with that at all, because I think the forward capacity market is going to divest the states of the ability to choose the types of technology that we're going to invest in. It's going to change the time horizon that we're going to be able to make those investments in.
That would be true of any rate, any long-term rate determination.
No, it wouldn't, because as the FERC has relied upon a number of different cases, Mississippi Industries and Groton, those are also where the FERC is allocating the cost. And it's important to understand that those are allocating the cost of existing capacity and not necessarily new capacity. Forward capacity market is actually forcing us to go out and acquire a new generation plant, and that the FERC cannot do without, because it will violate sections 201 of preventing us from enlarging our generation facilities. I am running short on time. I also wanted to address the Mobile Sierra issue to reserve at least some time.
Yeah, we'll
for
give
that.
You a little extra time because we've been asking.
Although I have to say, counsel, your Mobile Sierra issue may be the strongest argument in the whole case.
Then thank you. I would like to have the opportunity to address that briefly.
Well, that may mean you need less on that
less
one.
Less time.
Yeah.
I tell you one thing that would be helpful for me with respect to Mobile Sierra is if you could explain to what rates those clauses will or will not apply. That is, the two sides seem to be disagreeing considerably on when a just and reasonable hearing or determination will have to be made and when not. Could you give as clearly and unjargonly as you can what you think the just and reasonable test would still apply to and what you think the public interest test would apply to under these clauses.
We think the public interest test should not be applied.
No, I know what you think it should. I'm asking you, there appears to be a disagreement as to what it does apply to, forgetting about whether it's lawfully applied.
There's no question that Section 4.C says that both the rates that come out of the forward capacity market mechanism, the auction results, and the transition payments shall not be considered under just and reasonable
standard. What does FERC mean when it says that there has to be a filing after the rate and that will be judged under just and reasonable, and then after that?
My understanding of the FERC's argument, and I'll let them correct this, is that there will be a filing once the forward capacity auctions are, the results are approved, and then the results will be filed at the FERC. And
the results, namely the rates that come out?
Namely the rates that will come out, whatever they are.
Yeah.
They will be filed with the FERC, and they will be tariffed.
Yeah.
And that is when the FERC presumably is there's no process for this. They may just rubber stamp it. There's no understanding that
it has to be approved as just and reasonable at that stage?
There is no mechanism under the settlement agreement to provide for exactly what the FERC is going to do.
Well, now I'm really confused.
Me too.
I thought the settlement agreement, your position was the settlement agreement requires that be judged under the public interest standard, no matter who challenges. Isn't that your position?
Yes, no matter who challenges it. And in fact, I think it binds the commission as well. So if
FERC interprets the settlement agreement not to mean that, but rather that the actual rates will be challenged under just and reasonable by anybody, then what is your complaint?
I think the FERC has not interpreted that. The FERC has said that if we or any other party that objects to the structure of the transition payments or objects to the structure of the auction results, we cannot go and file a Section 206 complaint and say we want to review this. Unfortunately, it's going to be reviewed under the same PEPCO standard that's virtually insurmountable.
Let me ask you, in the intervener's brief, they make the point that where FERC says, for example, there'll be all these opportunities to challenge the rates, that in fact, what, as they say, FERC has failed to tell the court, is that what it's referring to is compliance filings, where you don't get an opportunity to attack the substance of the justness and reasonableness of the rates. Do you agree with the analysis in that brief?
Yes, I do. And the reason is that the fact that they make a compliance filing, as they're required to do for any rate that's going to be implemented, does not mean that it gives the opportunity of the Connecticut Attorney General and Massachusetts Attorney General the ability to come in and contest those rates. If we were to contest it, we would have to do it under Section 206 proceeding, and as the settlement plainly indicates, we would be restricted to the public interest standard.
Could I ask you, this is unorthodox, could you pick up the FERC brief for a minute, turn to page 55? So it's the full paragraph, and in the middle of it, it says, as the Commission explains, those prices, talking about the FCM, do not become final until ISO New England has made both an informational filing prior to the auction and a post-auction filing containing the results. Both filings will be addressed under the just and reasonable standard before the public interest standard attaches. Now, will be addressed, of course, is in the passive voice also. There seems to be a lot of this passive voice today. What is the problem with this from your point of view, and or is this just wrong, that this is not correct?
This is not reflected in anywhere in the settlement agreement. This is the FERC's interpretation of what it is going to do once it receives a compliance filing from the ISO. When it does receive the compliance filing, I imagine the Commission can do whatever it wants. It can just...
Well, Council, if this were the proper interpretation of the agreement, would you be content?
No, absolutely not, because a rate that's just and reasonable when it gets filed can also become unjust and reasonable 6 months, 12 months down the road.
How long do these auction prices last?
It depends. The auction prices for new units can last as long as 5 years. The auction prices for existing units can last only for shorter periods of time.
I'm sorry, counsel, I still don't understand, and I want to probe this hard because this is the thing that puzzled me the most. If both filings will be addressed under the just and reasonable standard before the public interest standard attaches, what do you understand that to mean?
That to me indicates that the FERC is going to receive a filing from the ISO. It is going to give a peripheral review of that filing.
Peripheral review? Peripheral?
Many of these contracts are approved without any kind of an analysis that gets published or reviewed. Frankly, since it is not addressed in the settlement agreement, I don't know what to make of a representation that's been placed in the brief, and I would prefer.
In other words, but if it meant that you would have full opportunity to challenge the rates under the just and reasonable standard, would you have any objection?
Yes, I would. And the reason is because it subsequently divests us of our ability to bring a Section 206 complaint. If
Why?
We know,
206, just and reasonable would be 206, wouldn't
no,
it?
But,
no,
what you're
but the rights
is,
would be terminated as of the section.
Right. So the next, what was the rest of the sentence says before the public interest standard attaches. So your argument is that even if just and reasonable is applied to the immediate result of the auction, the Mobile Sierra Clause prevents a later attack on that same rate?
Precisely.
That's it.
Yes, but furthermore, I thought the point that the intervener's brief made is when you read this sentence, all it says is both filings will be addressed under the just and reasonable standard before the public interest standard attaches. But the only issue in a compliance filing, says the intervener's brief at 25, is not the substantive provisions of the rate that's produced, but simply whether the compliance filing is constitutes a just and reasonable implementation of the settlement agreement as approved by the commission, which is a very different thing.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point, because once the compliance filing is in, there is not going to be any individual examination of the cost of new entry, the cost of maintaining capacity for any of the individual parties. It's going to be, did the auction price actually, was it a workably competitive auction? Were there enough participants? Nice. And I think that's right. More the review that they're looking towards.
All right. You want to save some time?
For rebuttal?
Yeah.
I'd be happy to, yes. Thank
well,
you.
My
understanding is we had reserved time for Council of Maine only.
We sort of cut short your Mobile Sierra argument, but why don't you save your time and then we'll.
The answer to that question is always yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, yes.
Just in case.
You didn't really have any. She just gave you more.
That's why the answer is yes.
Thank you. Counsel for the commission.
Thank you very much, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Dennis for the commission. Let me actually start where we just left off to try
Great.
And clear up some
Excellent.
Confusion.
Wonderful.
If you look to paragraph 185 of the commission's first order, and that's at JA 2051, the commission explains there
oh,
exactly.
Hold on a second. Let us get there.
Okay.
JA
2051. It's in the third volume of the appendix.
Two zero five one.
And it's paragraph 185 on that page when you get there.
Okay.
The way this Mobile Sierra provision was crafted by the parties and the way the commission interpreted it is the Mobile Sierra public interest standard, which we all agree is some higher standard, will attach to the transition payments after they were deemed just and reasonable in this case, as well as to the results of the forward capacity auctions after the ISO and the parties make a filing with the results of the auction. The commission interpreted these provisions as requiring the ISO to make a Section 205 of the Federal Power Act filing, the normal course of proceedings in most commission cases. The commission will review the results of the auction under that standard. It will notice the filing, it will accept comments, and it will address evidence and issue an order on those. Only after the commission has finally approved those rates will the public interest
so it's
standard
not
attach.
Just a compliance filing?
No, what Judge Rogers was going to, I believe, in the intervener's argument, there were compliance filings that needed to be made after the settlement agreement to implement market rules to actually put this thing into place. All we had at this point was a settlement agreement reflecting the parties' agreement.
But just to be absolutely clear, mm-hmm. the FERC's understanding of the agreement is that once there's an auction, there will be rates.
Yes.
Those rates will have to be filed, mm-hmm. and the normal proceeding for determining whether those rates are just and reasonable, including the rights of the people sitting at the other table to come in and argue that they're not, will occur, same normal burdens of proof, et cetera.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it's only after you make a finding with respect to those rates that they're just and reasonable that Mobile Sierra kicks in. Is
exactly.
That right?
That's exactly.
And then
correct.
For the remainder of the life of those rates, only public interest is the test.
Right. And those rates under the forward capacity auctions will apply for a year.
Where do we find that, counsel? I just want to be very clear. You're citing us to paragraph 186.
185 describes the commission's view and its agreement with the parties who filed reply comments supporting the settlement that this is how these provisions will work.
But see, it says 185 says the ISO will make both an informational filing prior to the auction, and then it's going to be followed. It says. Information regarding the zones to be used in the qualifying bids and a Section 205 filing following the auction containing the results. Now, you're saying that second part is a full 205 proceeding?
They actually both are, Your Honor, and I should have also pointed you, and I'm sorry, I'm going to make you flip through your JA again. The rehearing order reiterates these findings.
But just the key point is this next sentence, which says the limited Mobile Sierra provisions do not apply to these filings. That's your point.
That's correct.
All right. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Can I come back? I want to ask you this simple conceptual question.
Sure.
Is it fair to say that but for this approval of this settlement agreement, non-settling parties would be able to challenge continued application of rates under the just and reasonable standard? You are deviating in some respect from existing authority that non-settling parties would, or anybody would have, to challenge existing rates.
Judge Silberman, I think that this is certainly, we all agree that there would be a higher standard under this settlement if the parties were to come in later under the...
So you're deviating from your normal practice now.
Well, the commission's...
Or at least you're approving a deviation from your normal practice. And although you've always done that and been able to do that with respect to settling parties, you've never done it with respect to a non-settling party.
Well, to take your last point first, the commission has routinely done this with regard to non-settling parties, and it's consistent with the commission's policy.
Mobile Sierra?
Yeah, the commission has, consistent with its policy for the last several years, admittedly, the commission changed its policy around 2002, but the commission has routinely approved settlement agreements that apply the public interest standard to both parties and non-parties.
Okay, now, what cases approve that?
The commission cites a number of cases in its order.
No, I mean court appeals cases.
Well, the commission stated in its orders that it is aware of no authority, court of appeals or otherwise, that would permit a third party to challenge a approved individual arrangement under a just and reasonable standard. And we've been pointed to no case here as well. This is an issue. This is an issue of what the public interest standard means. Is an issue that is.
I understand that, because I just want to be clear that if FERC approves some rates, I mean, all the time we're seeing these cases challenging the rates.
Correct. Under Section 206, you mean when?
Yes.
Yes. And always under Section 206, no matter what we agree, no matter what we think the public interest standard means, and that's a question that the Supreme Court's going to address next week, in fact, but no matter what we think it means, under Section 206, there is always a higher burden for parties to come in and undo.
Now, as I understand the argument here, taking your reading of paragraph 185, after you have that, those two filings where you say it'll be a full, just and reasonable mm-hmm. review, including this Section 205 filing.
Right.
Then, once the rates in that 205 filing are approved, that's just and reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Then Mobile Sierra kicks in.
Correct.
So if 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, the state wants to object that a rate is unjust and reasonable, the Mobile Sierra standard kicks in, and the just and reasonable standard is no longer available to it.
Well,
I thought that's what the intervener's brief was trying to point out to us.
The intervener's brief was pointing that out, correct.
Yeah.
Were you going back to your earlier question about the compliance filing issue? Because I did want to address that as
no,
well.
No,
no,
it's
okay.
A more basic question. Counsel, let me, if
can
I
you
may
just
try.
Answer this
yeah.
second
answer.
Question? In other words, after we've gone through the 185, paragraph 185,
mm-hmm.
and the commission has approved these rates as a result of the auction.
Yes.
And we've been through the full Section 205 proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
Then the compliance filings are made. Right?
No.
Well, my hypothetical is you go through the original filing, then you go through the Section 205 proceeding. The full 205 proceeding, as you've described it, with everybody able to submit comments as to why the rates are unjust and unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And then FERC makes a decision that certain rates are just and reasonable.
Yes. These are the results of the auction
we're
talking
right.
about. Yes.
Then any challenge thereafter is subject to the Mobile Sierra standard.
That's correct. That
so
is correct.
That does limit rights that previously existed, that third parties would have to come in and challenge the rates under, if they became unreasonable over time.
I wouldn't go that far. Certainly, the parties are going to have to meet a higher standard. That is correct.
No, here, let me put the question this way. If the Mobile Sierra clause was not in this agreement, what rights would Maine and Connecticut have that they've lost
because of
the agreement?
They would have.
What is the legal impact of the Mobile Sierra clause on the agreement as it applies to non-settling parties?
It simply requires these parties to meet a somewhat higher burden in challenging. We don't know
challenging
exactly.
What?
In challenging the rates already approved as just and reasonable.
Now, how can you do that? How can conceptually you do that? When the statute says just and reasonable, how can you impose upon them a greater burden when they didn't agree to it?
I don't understand.
It's just a simple question.
The Mobile and Sierra cases stand for the proposition that once rates have been agreed to, they've been filed, the commission has found them just and reasonable.
Agreed to.
Right. In the context of a situation where folks have agreed to them, but it's not a material extension, I would argue, of Mobile Sierra to suggest that once the commission has found rates to be just and reasonable, that there is that applying the standards of the Federal Power Act and the just and reasonable standard coming back later would have to meet a somewhat higher burden.
Well, would that be true? Forget about auctions. Forget about settlements. Forget about everything. You approve a rate. You know, somebody comes in, no agreement, you approve a rate. Is your position that thereafter, if somebody who's having to pay the rate claims 5 years down the line that that's no longer just and reasonable, your position is, sorry, just and reasonable is not the test? Public interest is the test.
No, I'm not. I'm not suggesting that at all. No, I'm
suggesting
that.
The only reason that public interest would be the test, whatever it means, it's obviously different than just and reasonable. Whatever justifies it, it's the contract between the buyer and the seller, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the agreement among the parties to an individualized arrangement. It could be a
settlement. So why is this different, given that there's no agreement, but at least with some of the people who are going to have to pay?
The commission has continually applied this.
Only since 2002. So when you say continually,
well,
this is a
right,
bit,
I agree.
You know,
but that is the commission's policy today.
Yeah, but now, what's the explanation for it's very nice that that's their policy, but unfortunately now we have judicial review. So what happens now? What's the explanation for why, when somebody doesn't agree, they can be, they're not permitted to make what at least the statutory language suggests, an argument that they can make.
The Commission's explanation in these orders, which is the best explanation I can give you, is that that they have found no authority, judicial or commission otherwise, that would permit a third party outside of the arrangements to come in later and challenge under an ordinary just and
reasonable. Why isn't the statute that authority?
Well, the way
the third party can come in and challenge the rates is unjust and unreasonable as it applies to them. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
If there's no agreement.
Yes.
Okay. So they're losing that right now. So what Judge Garland and Judge Rogers and I are all trying to understand is, forget your policy, what is the justification for that?
Well, let me step back for a minute. The Mobile Sierra cases said that when you apply the Mobile Sierra just and reasonable standard as between, now, admittedly, those cases involved two parties. You and I were contracting, and one of us wants to get out of that deal later.
Let me stop for a second. You and I can reach a contract whereby the contract will be governed by the law of Mozambique, which is, for some reason, enormously unfavorable to challengers of this arrangement. But that couldn't possibly apply. That contract couldn't possibly apply to someone who is not a contracting party, right? And we couldn't just say, okay, everybody who deals in business in Mozambique will have to apply Mozambique law, whether or not they reach by contract or not. So that's what we're puzzled by.
Well, I think a couple of points. I mean, first, we're in the context of a regulatory agency that approves the rates as just and reasonable. The Mobile and Sierra cases, if I can try to paraphrase them, stand for the proposition that when parties agree amongst themselves and they bring it to the commission, the Federal Power Act applies a somewhat different standard when an individual party wants to come in and undo those arrangements later.
Perfectly understand.
There is no case, I am not aware of a case that addresses the particular issue we're on right now, which is when you have third parties outside of the contract. This situation, until restructuring, came up in the context of two parties amongst each other.
Now suppose you lose on this proposition. What happens to your settlement?
I would hope that the court would remand for the commission to address this issue.
There's no severability here.
No, that's exactly right, Your Honor. The parties intended for this settlement to be in its entirety.
All right. Can we switch to transition payments?
Absolutely. I think if I could, I think the first point I would make in response to the argument we heard before, petitioners have suggested that the commission hasn't balanced these transition payments against the entirety of the settlement. I would suggest that that's completely incorrect. If you look at paragraph 74, which is just one example in the first order, the commission states there that after it's making its findings that the settlement as a whole is in the public interest and is just and reasonable and provides a just and reasonable outcome, the commission says it's then going to go on to consider the individual issues that were raised to ensure that when looking at these individual pieces of the settlement as a whole, that it is just and reasonable.
All right.
That is a balancing.
All right. So
under any fair.
Get to their second point.
The second point.
Well, namely that the transition payments are an integral part of this agreement, and FERC has not done what it needs to do in order to determine that the payments are just and reasonable.
Well, the petitioners are applying the wrong standard. The petitioners would have the commission make a merits determination on every individual aspect of the settlement, including the transition payment.
They're attacking your Trailblazers 2 approach.
They are, yes.
All right. And the question is, Trailblazers 2 reads nicely, but is it consistent with the statute? That's their basic argument here, isn't it?
I don't recall reading an argument that it was inconsistent with the statute. I believe their basic argument is that the commission was somehow arbitrary and capricious in its analysis of the transition payments as compared to.
Yeah, I think their argument is, even assuming Trailblazer is correct, you're misapplying it here, because the 4-year, 5-year transition payments are such an enormous part of the entire structure of this agreement.
The 3.5-year transition payments,
whatever it is,
just to clarify that. Those payments are certainly a key portion of the settlement.
In fact, that is their argument.
Their argument, in fact, is that it is the central premise of the settlement, and that is the argument that I would disagree with today.
Well, let's assume that we don't need to hang our hat on that. but it is a part of this integrated agreement that has no severability clause.
Correct.
All right, so it's key in that sense.
Yeah, oh, certainly. I'm not telling you it's not a key part of the settlement. I'm telling you it's absolutely not the central piece of the settlement.
And while I agree with you, they may not frame the argument the way I said it. That's what it boils down to, that FERC has a statutory duty to determine whether rates are just and reasonable.
Correct, and the commission met that duty here.
And you can't do that, they say, under your trailblazers approach that sort of says, well, these may not be just and reasonable if we were to look at them in isolation, but viewed in the total picture of the settlement agreement and all we're trying to accomplish, they are.
I think, Your Honor, the commission, Trailblazer 2 explains, Trailblazer 1 and Trailblazer 2 and the Trailblazer 2 approach, those get confused, but the commission looks at the overall outcome of the settlement to determine that when you look at the settlement as a package and you look at everything the settlement does, it is just and reasonable. The commission recognizes in that approach that there may be certain individualized pieces of that settlement that could be problematic standing on their own.
And then that's where they come in and say, as I understand it, look, under the statute, the commission has an obligation to determine whether rates are just and reasonable. And its analysis for doing so here simply doesn't withstand review.
I would disagree. I mean, I think we have to recognize here that we're in the context of a settlement, and so the commission has to apply somewhat different standard. But it is not applying a standard other than the statute. It is still applying the just and reasonable standard of the statute. It is just recognizing that this settlement agreement contains many interrelated parts. The parties, a wide, diverse group of parties, agreed to it in a arm's length give and take negotiation.
The argument put in its bluntest form, all right, was that this was a windfall that has no relationship to revenue needs of existing generators. All right?
Right.
And FERC rejects that. All right? And the whole point of this agreement was to come up with a system that would enable these existing generators to have a revenue flow. And then this transition is just to get to that system.
Correct.
Now, what does FERC give us? And we've talked a little bit about this already. It talks about the end run of the litigation. It talks about the cost of new entry. And we've heard, well, there's not going to be any new entry in this 3.5-year period. There's no existing market. We have no idea what the actual expenses and revenues of existing generators are. So, you know, we're dealing in a never-never land.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. The commission had to, I mean, I have to go back, and this seems like dodging, but the commission had to apply its traditional standards for approving settlements. The commission looked at what the likely outcomes of litigation would be, and it said, even if we were to reach a just and reasonable conclusion within the range from what the ALJ approved in her decision, even if we were to take many of the aspects of that decision and redo them to make the overall rates lower.
You're talking about the 3.5-year transition
right.
agreement.
These rates would still be lower.
Say that again. If we were to make the rates lower, these would even be lower.
These would be comparable, if not lower.
This was the key determination that FERC makes, that if we had, hypothetically, if we had gone through a cost of service analysis, I guess, for the 4 years, the rates would have been higher than these rates. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the commission didn't say it would have gone through a cost of service analysis. It said it would have continued down the path of litigation
if you go down the path of litigation, I was a little confused about it. What is FERC's view as to hypothetically what that result would have been? Now, of course, petitioners say that's pie in the sky. You can't even figure out what that is. But what is your understanding of what FERC is saying was the hypothetical end result of the litigation?
FERC's hypothetical, or FERC's not hypothetical, but its analysis of the underlying price projections had the case continued to litigation, was that rates were likely to fall somewhere within the range of the ALJ's decision on the high end and a demand curve proposed by Maine and Vermont on the very low end. So the commission could assume that even if it were to agree with Maine and Vermont on every issue it presented on exception to the ALJ's decision, these rates would still be comparable.
But what basis
comparable, if not lower.
All right, but what basis did it have for saying that what Maine and Vermont proposed was reasonable?
The commission didn't have to go that far.
No, but what I mean, if parties are proposing things that are just not reasonable, the fact that something lies within the range of that doesn't tell you it's reasonable.
Well, I think my conclusion to that would be, even were that an unreasonable rate, right, it would have to be unreasonably low, wouldn't it? Because it was the low end of the range of plausible outcomes. These rates are comparable to that. The commission, following Trailblazer 2, in Trailblazer 2, the commission recognizes that it would chill settlements to reach merits decisions on the underlying litigation, on all of the various parts of the settlements. It would cut against its policy of promoting settlements, particularly in cases like this. That
I guess the basic argument is Congress has passed a statute. So you can approve settlements so long as they're consistent with the statute.
Correct. And the commission found that it was consistent with the statute
and
here.
And the statute says the commission has an obligation to find that rates are just and reasonable.
Normally,
it's looking at market or cost of service or something. And here, it doesn't tell us anything about the somethings it's using by which to determine this is it within a range of reasonable rates.
Well, two answers to that. I mean, first, the market versus cost is a false dichotomy. The courts have never required the commission take.
All right, I didn't say those were the only two options.
But sort of moving on from that.
Take into your consideration, if you will, in your answer, what we heard from counsel for Maine, Public Service Commission, saying that, existing generators, some of them, are not in need of this level of compensation during the transition period, given the high fuel rates.
The commission, particularly on rehearing, disagreed with that evidence. If you look at the evidence, it's two paragraphs and an affidavit that suggests that perhaps some generators are doing quite well. But keep in mind that the commission didn't approve these rates, didn't make a normal like it would if these came in by themselves under Section 205. It didn't approve them on the basis of existing generator costs. It approved them on the basis of...
In other words, what I'm trying to understand, and because you know this area much better than I do, is the commission telling us that the way I framed its argument in the beginning, that essentially everything it had before it, given the incentives of the parties involved, and the choices it made were consistent with the assumption that these existing generators needed a compensation payment during the transition that's this high, even if you were able to document that some existing generators don't need these payments.
The commission relied on evidence, you're correct, that as a general matter, revenues in the markets were severely lacking. And it had a lot of evidence to that point. I mean, just the underlying testimony throughout this proceeding, the existence of ever-increasing amounts of generators filing for reliability must run protection. So that the commission certainly had plenty of evidence on that point. What the commission is saying it did not have to do in the broad context of an overall settlement that it believed reached a just and reasonable outcome was to go all the way to the end zone, all the way to the merits finding on each particular element. Now, keep in mind with the transition payments, the commission certainly based most of its reasoning on its comparison to the likely outcomes of litigation, because that's what its precedent tells it to do. But also, the commission compared it to the cost of new entry figure that would be used in the forward capacity market, noted that it was significantly lower than that.
Can you say why that's all right as a ceiling or as a boundary for rates?
Well, the commission explained on rehearing, and it's paragraph 35 on rehearing, the commission explained a little bit about why it believes that the cost of new entry is relevant. It agreed with much testimony below that the cost of new entry is a reasonable pricing point when you're pricing capacity to ensure that capacity resources are appropriately compensated. The testimony will show that when there's a surplus, rates go below cost of new entry. When there's a or when there's not a surplus, it goes above. So
what about their argument that that new entry is not going to occur during the transition?
Well, the commission certainly agreed with that, but its purpose at this point, the commission wasn't just looking here at encouraging new entry. It was also ensuring that existing generators could remain online. Now, the cost of new entry figure would be a key price determining point in any other pricing scheme before it. And that would be paid to both new and existing generators. So the commission explained on rehearing that it believed that that was a relevant determination. I would also point out that the commission's explanation there was in response to very broad arguments on rehearing that the commission simply relied on irrelevant evidence. Much of the Cone arguments that you're hearing now on brief are much more refined and much more specific than the commission itself was presented with on rehearing. So the commission couldn't have gone all the way to the nth degree like petitioners might like them to now.
Are there other cases? I assume there are other cases where cost of new entry has been used as part of the measure of just and reasonableness, right?
Well, this case actually provides a perfect example because the commission approved the cost of new entry for the forward capacity market itself as a
precedence, not this case.
I can't point you to one right now, Your Honor. But certainly the testimony and the orders in this case agreed right even from June when it first set the locational installed capacity market for hearing that cost of new entry was going to be a key point of a key pricing point and a key litigated
I ask one last question.
Let me just ask you, which way does it cut in determining what the appropriate price for an existing generator? Which way does the cost of new entry cut?
Well, let's assume that these existing generators were just going to go in and bid in the market. It would depend on what the market price ultimately amounted to. If the market clearing price ultimately...
I'm trying to figure exactly how you tie it up. Okay, the existing generator is rather inefficient, and its cost is very high. Cost of service is high, hypothetically. The new entry would be more efficient, but you have to figure out what the cost would be to... All right, so how do you figure that? How does that work? How do you take the cost of new entry and plug it into the determination of what reasonable rates are today? What's the economic analysis?
Well, the commission didn't quite get that far in these orders because it wasn't presented
with
those.
It mentions Cone.
Certainly.
Yeah, but I'm trying to figure out why it's relevant. I mean,
let me give you my best.
I think it is relevant, but I want to hear you trace the economic analysis.
My best answer, and this is a lawyer playing economist, so bear with me, is that the pricing markets, or if you want to call them markets or administrative determinations, however you want to price capacity, they're generally designed to provide the cost of new entry when you are at the amount of capacity that you need to ensure that when you need new entry, you have a price that will support that new entry. So that's generally, and that's what the testimony that the commission cited to in its orders really goes to. And I may be...
Well, it could cut either way.
Well, certainly it could. Here it cuts very low, right? I mean, the transition payment the first year is $305, less than half.
No, my point is the cost of new entry can cut either way in determining what the reasonable rates or existing generators are.
Sure. If the commission was making a specific finding that here are our set of existing generators and here's what their costs are and here's what the cost of new entry is, but the commission didn't have to do that here. The commission had other bases to approve this temporary.
Sort of threw in the cost of new entry as sort of sprinkle dust, but I couldn't quite figure out which way it cut.
Well, it was further indication to the commission that these rates were not in any way excessive, I think, is the way to say it, that these rates would not.
The rates are lower than the cost of new entry. Right,
and the rates are lower than what these folks would likely receive from a litigated
outcome. Can I just be sure if I understand this? Did the commission find that the transition payments are just and reasonable?
It found the transition payments just and reasonable only as a part of this settlement, and it candidly admitted that it didn't consider these to be an ideal market design element.
But when it's ideal is a different question than whether it's just and reasonable. And so what I'm asking is about the paragraphs, the various sentences that say they are within the range of reasonableness, which is at paragraph 100, and in paragraph and in the rehearing petition where it says they're within a broad ambit of various rates that may be just and reasonable, and in paragraph 37 where it just says adequately supported our determination that the transition rates are just and reasonable.
Right. These are within a range.
Not the same rate that the commission would have chosen. Does the commission believe that the rates themselves are just and reasonable?
The commission, I think the best answer I can give is the commission believes they're in the range of possible just and reasonable rates. The commission recognizes that there is not one just and reasonable rate. But the commission is only making its findings with regard to the transition payments in the context of the settlement. We can't say what the commission would do outside of the context.
In the context of a settlement, by which you mean they're not doing the full analysis they would otherwise do, or by which you mean we're balancing that off against the other advantages and disadvantages?
Your second point. The commission was that's really what Trailblazer does, is it balances the give and take of litigation and where would the parties likely continue if we were to reject the settlement and continue down the road to litigation. And so as a package.
That's as a package with respect to the petitioners rather than as a package with respect to the world or the public interest or the other parties, is that right? That these petitioners are no worse off than they would otherwise be.
Right. It's directly addressing the points raised by these petitioners and their belief of where they should be on the in terms of what a just and reasonable rate would be. That wasn't a very artful answer, but hopefully.
Do you want to speak at all to the locational payment argument?
I would if you would grant me just a moment. I know I'm way over time. The commission offered several reasons why for this
evidence wasn't relevant. Maine's evidence wasn't relevant.
That was one reason. The petitioners here suggest that by stating that this wasn't relevant, the commission was somehow discarding its earlier findings. That's not what the commission was doing. The commission stated, we addressed Dr. Austin's evidence in the context of, again, the broad package of the settlement following Trailblazer. The commission offered several reasons why it didn't need to have a locational component to these particular transition payments. First, the capacity prices would be equal during this short period. Also, that reliability.
See how that works. I mean, if Maine says we're in a surplus situation where we can't export, I mean, why is it relevant that prices are going to be the same everywhere?
Because the price that these folks would be likely to pay is the same price that everywhere else in the region would be likely to pay. In other words, if we were able to implement the forward capacity auction and market today, which of course we can't do because it's 3 years forward, but if we were able to do it today, the auction would provide a single price for the entire region. That was the commission's finding there, and it was based on evidence that was presented to it with the settlement. The main parties didn't necessarily object to that evidence as much as they provided additional evidence. And the commission says on rehearing, to go to that point, I'd like to offer you the other reasons why it thought location was okay to do this in the short term. But that rehearing paragraph 72 at JA 2370 that they focus so much on, the commission was explaining there in the context of how it reviews these kind of settlements under Trailblazer that it doesn't have to litigate all the way to the end the issue of whether Maine is export constrained. It simply decided that based on the evidence it had before it, as well as the other considerations, which I'll lay out for you quickly, that reliability must run contracts are in place in other regions that are constrained, so they're actually paying a higher price for their capacity. And that the forward capacity market, the ultimate end product of the settlement, has a locational component as well. I'm happy to address other questions.
Nope, that's
I've
way over
my time.
Did you cover everything you want to?
I believe I did. I don't want to take up any more of the court's time. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for intervener.
May it please the court. I'd like to start by addressing Cone and then move to Mobile Sierra, if I may. Judge Silberman, the economic underpinning of why Cone is a rational approach here and
rational
how it cuts.
I didn't hear rational or irrational?
Rational. And how it cuts is as follows. And this is the key underpinning, actually, of the FCM market design, which no one has attacked before this court. The key precept of that design, as with LICAP before it, and as with all capacity market designs, in the modern age anyway, is that all suppliers, existing and new, should collect CONE, cost of new entry, CONE is a strange term to use, on average over time, but it oscillates. In times of oversupply, you're going to be below. In times of undersupply, when there's scarcity, you'll be above. At different points in time, Judge Silberman, existing generators may have margins that are positive or negative. When the margins are negative long enough, they're inefficient and they need to retire. That's what happens to them. Others will collect a premium, which is simply putting the acorns away for the winter for the times when the market trends downward. Everyone agrees with that proposition because it's not challenged here. Everyone also agrees that the value of CONE approved in the settlement of $7.50 is an appropriate value. Now, the commission went further and said this is actually a just and reasonable estimate of what the real life cost of new entry is for this purpose. And we have payments that are trending to less than half to a little over half in the transition period of this level. The commission specifically noted, and I submit, by the way, that the commission did essentially find that payments are just and reasonable, backed up and said, you know, we don't have to. Even if they're not, they're part of a broader balance. But the record here shows that they are. The commission specifically looked at the supply and demand conditions extant then and found that the payments were a, quote, accurate take on, you know, where we would be vis-a-vis CONE. They talked, though, I think that's probably conservative, about looming shortages in 2008, which is where we are now, to 2010, capacity shortfalls, potential blackouts, which suggests by now we would actually be getting CONE were we in a market. They specifically also referred to the historical ICAP market, which had a different structure with a cap based on CONE, which was $6.66. They said inflation, increases in cost of capacity, that supports the $7.50 number. That's another reason why the transition payments are just and reasonable. And if you look historically, this reliance on generic data that doesn't apply to anyone's cost of service and is keyed to the cost of a new peaker is what this court affirmed in the Groton case 30 years ago. It's how the New England markets have been built before there was a market, actually. A structure had been built for 30 years. And so, you know, this goes, Judge Garland, exactly to your point about hope. There is no stricture on how you set just and reasonable rates. And in fact, counsel for petitioner cited the Mobil Oil case, where if you go look, the Supreme Court went through the whole tortured history of natural gas production regulation and confirmed that you can set rates on an area or nationwide basis that have nothing whatsoever to do with individualized costs. Now, CONE also, by the way,
Your explanation of CONE, where will we find it in the record? Is it in one of the two opinions, or is it
The relationship to the FCM market is at JA 2037 and 2042. You'll find discussion of CONE vis-a-vis, I'm sorry, I'm using the acronyms, the locational ICAP market at 2364. You'll find the discussion about everybody agreeing that this is an appropriate metric at 2363. Now, I'm constrained to point out, and I feel badly because our brief did not do this. If you look at the rehearings from the petitioners themselves, they spent seven lines on CONE. You'll find these lines at JA 2124 to 25. What they said is no longer being argued on brief. They said CONE is excessive, citing a prior pleading which talks only about CONE in the context of a value for the FCM. They never addressed CONE as a metric found to be just and reasonable to assess the transition payments. All of what we've heard about the demand charges never being, or curves never being litigated to justness and reasonableness does not apply to this cost of new entry point. It is, I submit to you, a silver bullet on the transition payments, particularly when you take into account that the petitioners never challenged this rationale below.
A silver bullet for you or against you?
For me and directly, Judge Silberman, to the heart of the petitioner's case.
I understand.
Now, you know, I can also note that...
I hope the other side's got a really good metaphor to respond.
Yes.
I don't think they do. And when we talk about the zone of reasonableness and the demand curve sort of sizing the commission did, the real issue here is If you ask the petitioners what alternative they were posing that was outside that range, there's one, and it was addressed on policy grounds and rejected at the outset of this case. It's sort of the zero option. We go back to cost of service for everybody, the old RMR world. Right. The commission explained in lucid terms that are not expressly challenged here why that was the wrong way to go. It hurt other generators that did not get cost support, and it was not a direction they chose on policy grounds. There's no basis.
You mean they abandoned cost of service?
I'm sorry, I did not hear.
They abandoned cost of service as the desired basis for the 3.5 years of transition payments? I didn't understand that.
The traditional cost of service way of deciding the justice and reasonableness of rates was not used by the commission at any stage in this case. It's what the petitioners want to return this market to.
Yes.
And there's no basis for cramping the commission's discretion in interpreting the statutory standard in that manner. I will add now, Judge Silberman, this is not to say that what the agency can do is simply, you know, throw aside any requirement to explain its decision and throw a dartboard between a range and say, that's where we are. But that's not what happened here. This is really a case about reasoned decision-making and whether the commission needed to have a trial on something and didn't. And when you apply those very familiar principles, which this court sees constantly, you find these orders are well above the minimum standards of reasoned decision-making. The commission triangulated the transition payments with Cone, with the demand curve analysis. It talked about other benefits, such as availability. It thoroughly addressed these arguments, and we believe the transition payments are solidly above fair criticism on judicial review.
You were going to talk about Mobile Sierra?
I was, Your Honor. First of all, the Supreme Court did not repeal the Power Act or the Gas Act when it issued those decisions. When the Commission is applying the public interest standard, it is simply addressing the statutory standard in a certain way, given the context presented to it. And this question, actually, I'm
not suggesting there's no difference between public interest and just and reasonable, are you?
I'm suggesting that the statutory standard is met either way. And when we talk in the terms that were being used earlier in this argument, it's best to modify the term just and reasonable in terms of ordinary or traditional concepts, where you come in a rate case and you say, the pipeline's been out of the rate board for 3 years. The cost of capital's gone down. I want to file a complaint. What Mobile and Sierra say is there are sometimes, and they talked about the contract context. I'm going to tie it to this case in a second. There are sometimes when you need a higher standard. As to the third-party point, by the way, and I speak, by the way, in Mobile Sierra for myself and the supplier side. Some of my brethren on my brief would not, you know, support these arguments. But in the third-party context, I'm constrained to point out that in the Mobile and Sierra test itself, third parties are envisioned as part of the public interest test. The court says cast an undue burden.
Are you telling us it doesn't matter if we rule against you then? You're basically trying to argue that, this court itself has said that where there are third parties involved, the public interest test, Papagayo and I can't remember what the other case is, that it's a different standard than when there are just two parties to the contract. Public interest is different. So if you seem to be saying, as Judge Silberman was asking, are you saying they're the same? If that case, we can rule against you and you won't mind.
No.
Why not?
Not quite, for two reasons, Judge. First of all, the public interest standard applied to third parties, while not necessarily quite as strict as applied to contracting parties, is a higher standard than petitioners would seek here. And what I was saying,
a higher standard than FERC would see here. In other words, let's say we ruled against you, and they then challenge an auction price that's been in effect for 3 years or something, and FERC says, well, we're going to apply just and reasonable because the court said we had to, but under these circumstances, under the circumstances in which we have an auction price, we have an entire pool, et cetera, this is just and reasonable, although we might not have so held, because just and reasonable means a zone, we might not have so held if this was just a one-on-one contract. And we don't have that case today, so you can make that argument later.
I agree in significant part with what you said, but I do not agree that it does not matter. I think if the commission were addressing this question from square one, they would take account rationally of the fact that there was a history and there was a prior decision litigating to finality the justice and reasonableness of the auction prices. And by the way, if a new entrant comes in, it is 5 years reducing to three that rate is in effect, and that rate is only for that one new entrant. For the auction process generally, and all existing suppliers, we're talking about a rate that is in effect for only 1 year. So the whole notion of having to reopen the rate because time has passed is, I think, a red herring in this context.
Well, then it'll be a waste of time for the other side to try to do that. And nothing, you would argue nothing had changed.
But it's still true, but it still provides critical support for the market and prevents new entrants from having to charge risk premiums to make themselves whole for regulatory risk. But
depends going back on how big a risk premium there is. If FERC, you get a few examples, and FERC says, this was agreed to by the auction, nothing's changed in the last year, or you can't show anything significant has changed, we're going to reject a challenge.
Simply because I will stand here before you and contend that a rational decision by the FERC in those contexts would take account of a prior decision and the need for certainty, does not necessarily equate to the protections in the agreement and in the order that granting public
you
interest
told
protection.
Us you can't tell us exactly what it means to say public interest test in the context of a third party.
You seem to suggest, in terms of a third party, FERC would come up with some intermediate position between what it would do to a contracting party and what it would do under cost just and reasonable.
No.
Wow.
Not quite.
You suggest. Somewhere in the middle.
No, I'm suggesting that we look to Mobil and Sierra itself, which tell us what the standard is, while giving FERC some leeway to look at other factors. If the agreement casts an undue burden upon other consumers, meaning not the consumer under the contract, or is unduly discriminatory, you know, with the expectation that there could be a third party coming in and saying, wait a second, I had nothing to do with this transaction, I'm being discriminated against. That's what you would look at. But, you know, in truth, Your Honor, this claim of third party is a little bit odd, because what we have here are third party beneficiaries of the settlement agreement, because they're getting the forward capacity market they protested so sternly for. They got a sense of Congress on it.
We understand that context.
Okay.
All right. Now, thank you. I think we will hear from petitioner for Maine PUC. Just a couple minutes.
Number of points I'd like to address. One is just very briefly on the wide number of parties. Maine and Massachusetts are 53% of the load, and that's not even counting Connecticut, which
53% of what?
Of the load in New England. Yeah. So that's just Maine and Massachusetts, and that's JA 1870. Adding Connecticut is another 25%, which makes it 75% of the load. I'd like to note Trailblazer, the standard is just and reasonable and no higher. And so the FERC was required to make the just and reasonable determination regardless of its no higher than. And we pointed out that it failed to do that. There is talk about the path of litigation, but FERC abandoned LICAP, as did ISO New England, that stood strongly behind the FCM. So our contention is that FERC would have been required to address alternatives even without the sense of Congress, at least eventually. LICAP was not the only path of litigation. We've already discussed that their analysis of locational installed capacity mechanism was mechanical and without any level of analysis. The fact that the rates are lower than rates that have not been shown to be just and reasonable does not make them reasonable. Laclede stands for that proposition. The argument that there may be generators that do need additional revenue was addressed by Dr. Austin, who said you could make the transition payments lower when you knew what the generators needed. And if that still wasn't high enough for the truly high cost generators than RMRs are still available, and no one can test that RMRs are still in use during the transition period. So it's RMRs and transition payments. And so you could reduce the price to the level that was reflects the amount needed by generators to continue to be available, as is the standard in NSTAR. And you still have the option of RMRs. Again, the cost of new entry is a market function. Mr. Estes' explanation of it is an eloquent description of the market mechanism, how it works in a market. The problem is there's no market here, and FERC's entire justification was compensatory, and in that sense, it doesn't have any relationship. FERC counsel says, in I think a post hoc rationale, that FERC didn't really mean that export constraints were irrelevant. They just meant they weren't quite as relevant. Clearly, they're relevant because the whole case was about export constraints. Mr. Estes' point, which he failed and FERC failed to bring up, about the level of discussion about CONE is not properly before the court. We believe it's that we've addressed that.
Anything
issue.
Further, counsel?
Excuse me.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you
very much.
Counsel for Connecticut et al.
Thank you very much. I'd like to address briefly the FERC's contention earlier that they're not aware of any case where a third party would be, I think the quote is, come in and undo these arrangements. I'd like to say there is authority for that. It's Section 206 of the Power Act. It speaks specifically to when a third party can come in and try and contest those arrangements. And there are a lot of cases on that. In fact, any time there's a case with a Section 206 challenge is going to, by definition, going to...
We understand that, Counsel.
Okay, thank you. There are no Supreme Court cases, there are no circuit court cases whatsoever that support the proposition that you can have a third party bound, and I see that I have made that point clearly. So I would take one last stab only at the jurisdiction argument unless you feel that it's been a long day.
Well, if you have something critical to say.
No, the one last thing about the forward capacity auction process, and I think one of the most important things a state considers in determining whether or not what the level of resource adequacy is going to have is going to be the cost of that resource level. Whatever the reserve margin in has a direct cost to consumers. Under the forward capacity auction, we don't know what the cost is until the auction is completed because the installed capacity requirement goes in first. In other words, this settlement puts the cart before the horse. We really think it really impedes the state's ability to meet its resource adequacy requirements. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at
Thank you.